About how everybody got into comics was a weirdo back then, because I've done my best to remain a weirdo ever since, thank you very much. What I remember most is, first thing I remember is those meetings at the park, where myself, my two brothers, and a couple of other high school age kids, Mike Williams and Gary Pago, we all saw my mother saw the ad in the paper, and she shooed us out of the house, and we went on down there and started volunteering for whatever we could do. We were all high school age or younger. But one of the things I liked about Richard right away was the fact he didn't treat us like high school kids. He treated us like just more of the committee, and whatever we were willing to do, he was willing to trust us to do it. I remember the lot of us folding the original program book and stapling it. And then the second year, with the convention at UCSD, by that time I had joined the SCA, and we had a whole bunch of SCA stuff going on, and he just welcomed us right in. We provided security back in those days. You see all these professional security guys out there now, but back then it was a bunch of weirdos in mail with pole arms standing around looking menacing. And we had our fair share of fighting demos, and a number of people met each other and got married, including the heads of my household. But the thing about Richard was, he was the chairman, I was sorting out the mail stuff, and we just worked as a team. And after that, he kept on with the Comic-Con. I got into the SCA, but I remember him fondly.
Okay, thanks. One of the next people to meet Richard was David Clark, who was on the early comic committee and was even at the MiniCon, their first event back in March of 1970.
Yeah, it was part of the group of science fiction fans from Crawford High School, and along with Greg Bear, Scott Shaw, John Town, Roger Friedman, all people that have been involved in the field in this convention off and on for many, many years. We had a club, a science fiction club that met in Ocean Beach in a bookstore, Ken Kruger's bookstore. And a Michelle Dorf came down one evening and introduced him, and then we were introduced to his group of comic fans. And we went to a meeting in Claremont. And that's where I first met Richard, was at that meeting. Early convention, but what I really remember the following year, I entered the Army. I was drafted in the Army. I was in the Army for a couple of years. And when I came back in 1974, I was rooming with that fellow sitting right over there in kind of a swell, big old house that we used to have great parties. And Saturday night, I was sitting in the bathtub thinking about, I've really got to get a job. I was living on the GI Bill. I need to get a job. And I heard a commotion out in the living room, and I got, what is that? And I got up, and you've heard that old song, Splish Splash, I was taking a bath, all on a Saturday night. That's exactly what happened. And I found some clothes and poked my head out there, and there was Richard L., who I already knew from the conventions. And he had opened his comic book store, The Comic Kingdom, on University Avenue. And there was some problem with the shop. He said, I got to get somebody in there right away. Do you know anybody that's looking for, the work in the shop? I was like, yeah, I do. Me. So the next day I went down with Richard and started working my first civilian job, which was working at Richard Alf's Comic Kingdom. And Richard was often a presence at our house at 4th Avenue. Here someone's just handing me one of the cards from it. I think this is a little... Is that one of his original ones? Yeah. It's Scott Shaw. The image and the logo. We used to host a very nice parties at 4th Avenue House, probably about once a month or so. And Richard was a regular fixture at those parties. One of the things I remember about Richard is, of course, his laugh, but also his ability to fall asleep at the drop of a hat. So you'd be having a conversation with him, make some pithy comment, and look at Richard would be, he'd be snoring. He'd wake back up, and it'd like nothing happened. But anyway, it's one of those funny quirks. But I'm getting a little nap along the way. But I always enjoyed working for Richard, and he gave me my first break, as it was.
Thanks. Are we able to play the video? video just tonight. Okay, well, we're almost ready for the video, but already Bob Beerbaum, a dealer who was at the first three-day convention in August of 1970, and he was has been there just until recent times at every convention, and he met Richard early on, and even before he met Richard, was aware of him as a dealer. So, Bob.
Well, yeah, but Richard was one of the first people to be advertising in Marvel Comics. Actually, he was sending lists out to people that were in the Blackhawk trading corner, these letter columns and these letters, and buying, selling, and trading Blackhawk comics from the 40s and 50s. He'd send his lists out. He's advertising. He had no idea he was a teenager putting these little quarter-page ads or little classified ads in the Marvel Comics. Because then some of us were sending off all these lists and stuff, and then sending things into he'd have these buying lists and stuff like this. And so I'm out in the middle of Nebraska, where we had moved back from Saudi Arabia, and I'm finding these comic books for like a nickel, 5 cents a piece in these used magazine stores, and ship them out to Richard and Claude Held or Howard Rogowski and get dollars for them. And at some point, I started doing comic book conventions in 1967, 68, and 70. I drove out to Suling's show in the summertime, and then to out to, was it the U.S. Grant or the U.S. San Diego Union? I keep forgetting which one's which. Because what was your first
one?
Grant was the first one, San Diego was the second one. And but what was interesting on the 72 show, Bud Plant and I and a few other guys had started up a the convention promoters had kind of gotten together. So the first circuit for comic book conventions was in 72, and it was like 8 shows over 9 weeks. And that culminated at the first El Cortez show. So, I mean, Bud and I and like Terry Stroud and stuff, we'd like stay at these Motel 6s along the way, and we'd cram all these young guys into a room like 75 cents a night. And we'd like play cards for who got the pillowcases and the mattress or the bed boards or the blanket or the sheets, and cut cards and all the way down to there. And but at culminating when I got all the way back across country to the San Diego show, where I was going to be at this place called the El Cortez, I get there and there's no record of me having paid for my tables, and the room's all sold out. And I'm going, oh Jesus, here I'm like 1,800 miles from home, and it's like no place to sell my stuff. And but I had my canceled check with me. So what Richard did was he just like quick went over, because the room I remember with being in had a stage in it, but there was a banquet room around the corner somewhat. He goes and gets this big giant round table, this banquet table, and puts it right at the door. So you kind of had, I don't know if people remember, you kind of had to squeeze around my table at this point to get in. So, which like turned it into a big 4+, and all these other dealers were like jealous. I'm saying, blah blah blah, because you had to squeeze around me to get in the rest of the room. And but during the course of it's either Saturday or Sunday, I don't remember what, there was this guy comes in, and he just had left his wife's father's funeral. He's like really bummed out. He heard about this thing called a comic book show, and we got to talking. We were sitting there talking for a long time, and he found a Walt Kelly's Brownies. I remember it was a brown time kind of cover that had a dog in a bathtub, in a little wooden tub and stuff like this. It's from 1949. He goes, well, I had one of these when I was a kid, and he gives me $2 for it. And it turns out it was Tom French, who ended up becoming the dealer's liaison. He took care of us in that dealer's room and fought for us for a long time. And he finally passed away. But then the whole show has now evolved into something that, I mean, I've got no complaints about it. I set up at the first 42 of these in a row, but this is the first year of just, it's like an end of an era in a way. This is, I mean, some people complain, I'm not. It's just an evolutionary process dealing paper in a digital age. It's like 10 years ago, my father was telling me, son, you're one of the last wagon masters. But what he was talking about was the internet, and he never owned a computer. But he says, Remember when there was all these coins and stamp stores like all over the country? Every little town would have three or four of them, and all these shows everywhere. Man. It's the same kind of thing where the evolution of comics, they're always going to be here. They've been here for hundreds of years. They're all going to be on the e-readers and those Kindles. And everybody's going to walk around. And anyways, my memory of Richard is that 72 show where he just quickly solved problems. It's like he took whatever it took to make it work. And coming out with this big giant round table that put me slap right in the doorway, blocking everybody coming in and out. It was kind of cool. And if I hadn't been there, I never would have met Tom the way I did. Because he was really depressed when he came to his first El Cortez show. This was, then the following year we were out to the airport, then the year after that they had built that building in the back. And I think that by that point Tom had become a dealer's liaison for the room, but Richard was kind of like off on a different direction, is my memory.
Okay, thank you. Right? I think we're ready to play the video now.
There we go.
Speakers. The idea all along was to showcase not only comics, but science fiction and films.
So we opened the door and we said, everybody, anybody who has any sort of interest in anything that's basically related to comic books and has a pulse, is willing to work with us, the door's open, come on in.
And that's how it all started, according to Comic-Con founders Richard Alf, now 59, and Mike Towering, now 56. But this was Richard back in 1970 at age 17, and this was Mike at age 14. Two Sarah Mason teenagers who were into comic books and who would organize the first Comic-Con.
In the beginning, we were just enthusiastic amateurs that didn't know any better and had no idea that we should be able to do something like that because we were just kids.
But the kids had come in contact with Shel Dorf, an older comics fan who had moved to San Diego but had put on the Trojan Fanfare comic book convention in Detroit. Dorf wondered about something similar here in San Diego.
He says, what about a comic book convention? You guys certainly have a local convention for comic books. And I said, Shel, we not only don't have one, he says, I didn't even know that the worship site was.
But soon Dorf talked the teens into organizing a San Diego comic book convention. Though some thought comic book readers were an odd fringe group.
If you're over a certain age and still reading comics, there's something wrong with you, you're just a social outcast.
But Alf put up $1,800 to finance the first convention because of Dorf's vision in comic book contacts.
I believe in where he's going, I'm going to stick to this guy like glue, and I'm going to work with him.
So in 1970, for 3 days at $3.50 admission, San Diego's Golden State Comic-Con was held in the basement of the U.S. Grand Hotel downtown, and the founders even went to ComicBiz, the Convention and Visitors Bureau, to see if it could help promote the first Comic-Con.
And one of the person says, oh, is this a convention for stand-up comics? They don't know.
Saturday's Comic-Con was held at the El Cortez Hotel downtown, a large venue then.
It seemed huge.
Yeah, it seems huge. It really did.
But it was all news to us. Now we're comparing it to the convention center.
Alf and Towery came back and remembered those years fondly here at the El Cortez.
So as long as we came in and didn't cause excessive amounts of trouble and pay our bills, that they would accept us here. And because we didn't have a lot of other business, maybe, I don't know, but because of that, we ended up here. And it was a great experience.
Comic-Con got nationwide credibility, bringing in speakers like science fiction writer Ray Bradbury, and in 1974, a rare convention appearance by artist Charles Schulz, the creator of Peanuts. The two founders say, looking back, it's overwhelming to think how far Comic-Con has come. It's kind of the ultimate revenge of the nerds.
We've gone from being the underdogs and pulling down on to something that comic books are now the touchstone for all this other media, all these other ideas, all these other concepts. And that, to me, is one of the most fascinating parts of the convention, to go from being an underground and not quite legitimate to being almost overly legitimate.
Overly legitimate.
Richard was chairman of the Comic-Con, the second one, the 1971 con at UCSD, and a good friend of ours.
Can you hear me in the back?
Yes.
All right, great. Oh, fantastic. All right. Richard, I could go on and on and on about Richard, but I actually first caught sight of Richard during the first 3-day con. It was on a Saturday, and I think it was the 2nd of August, I guess it was. And I saw this giant moving through this group of people that was about 6'5" tall, and his hair was almost as wide as he was tall. And I was long hair too back then. And I had just recently come from the Philippines, where I had been raised on military bases. And so a lot of the American experience was pretty new to me. And I had no idea. I was going to the first Comic-Con in San Diego. It was a girlfriend at the time. I said, hey, you should go to this thing. And so I was there for a few hours, and I remember this real tall guy. So a few months go by, and that same girlfriend was going to UCSD, and she gave me a little thing from the local school paper that said, noted comics authority, Richard Alf, will appear to speak at the student union. And so I said, oh, cool, there's a noted comic books authority. I never heard of such a thing. So I go to the student union, and it's absolutely empty. There's literally no one there but me and the lunch staff. And so I'm sitting, and I'm sitting, and I'm sitting, and about 5 minutes before, this big, tall guy who I noticed before the Comic-Con sits down, and I'm trying to place him. I said, God, he looks vaguely familiar. Oh, well. He looks like a Comic-Con kind of person, so I must be in the right place. And we sat there, 10 minutes go by, nobody comes. 15 minutes go by, nobody comes. 20 minutes go by, nobody comes. And about half an hour in, I walked over to him, and I said, you don't know me, but are you here for Richard Alf? And you heard Richard's laugh. He just burst out laughing. He said, yes, thank God, I am Richard Alf. So that's how we kind of met. And we very quickly became fast friends. And within a year, I was living across the street from Mike Towery, and we saw each other quite often. And Richard was just around the corner. And also David Clark here. I used to hang out at that infamous 4th Street party house where we did all kinds of crazy things. And there was Bill Paul down there, was down there at the same time. We all had a great time, but I remember from the 1970s. But Richard and I had something that went beyond just seeing each other at the convention every year. We became great friends. And I'm happy to say that I knew him for over 40 years. And we always stayed in touch. I can remember we used to go to Fellini movies all the time and drive around in his beaten-up old Volkswagen. He had to take me to the hospital one night because I partied a little too hardy. And after they discharged me from the hospital, I said, let's all go down to La Jolla Cove and take off our clothes and go moonlight nude swimming. And we did. And then we all got a chorus line of naked men who were doing a kick dance under the moon. And Richard laughing uproariously, his head off. So whenever I think of Richard, I think of moments like that. And God bless you, Richard. I hope you sleep.
That was the first El Cortez convention, and it got off to a rocky start, and it even looked for a while like it might not happen, and then Richard and I teamed up for that, and we got a lot of help from Dennis Smith, who had experience in science fiction conventions, and we were able to pull off the convention, and it was a wonderful experience. And Dennis, would you like to say something about Richard?
Well, I guess the most important thing that comes to my mind isn't, we had episodes, we had things happen. There's a lot of, I hear stories again and again. It seems like there are stories everywhere about Richard. But the most important thing to me is that Richard was a mellow, easygoing guy who was just a damn good friend. He was a guy you could rely on. And he was there. He was, and I'd run into him sometimes years ago, but I'd run into him in the oddest places. Always that laugh, always that demeanor that it's just uniquely Richard. I guess I'm not too much inclined to talk about a lot of this because all this history is coming out and everything. And I'm thinking more of a really personal element. I know, for example, he had a difficult relationship in his family. But there was a point where he called me up and he just wanted to show me something. And we got together and he took me over to his mom's house and showed me her paintings. Now, I don't know about you folks, but Martha Alf is a significant painter, a painter of note. And we went through them, and he just told me basically that the only reason he was able to do this was A, he wanted me to wasn't there. So this was very important to him. But he's the kind of guy who would, he would carry things in private. And yet, whenever you're at a group, you're in a gathering, you're, you know, the problems come up, if there's any way to take care of it, any way to solve it, any way to be a hell of a good friend, that was Richard.
And one of our guests that was early at the Comic-Con who loved the El Cortez conventions and knew Richard is George Clayton Johnson.
Yeah. I hardly knew Richard Alf. I ran into him at conventions from the very beginning. I was introduced to him two or three times. We nodded and smiled and tried to make conversation. But somehow it never quite gelled. Well, one day, Greg and Mike and Clayton Moore and Mr. William Clausen and myself, there was a half a dozen of us together, and it was suggested that with Shel Dorff in the nearby hospital, languishing, dying, that we ought to go visit him. So we did. We piled in cars and we went over there. They let us in two at a time, and the rest of us sat outside, in the waiting room, talking. And so I started to get acquainted with Richard. I saw his sense of humor. I saw how much everybody else revered him. I also saw that this is that group of kids that put on that first convention, that almost all of them were just out of their teens, and they did a hell of a job of it. I was just totally blown away by the whole idea of comics, because my wife, a long time ago, when they asked her what she wanted on a tombstone, she said, "I told you I was sick." And I thought that was very clever, but I couldn't think of anything for my tombstone except that the one thing I was proud of was I was a science fiction fan. I thought that placed me head and shoulders above everybody, because science fiction was sort of novel and new, and I had read all of it. I had gone to the libraries. In those days, one could become a total expert on the subject of science fiction because it was fairly new. So that when I was invited by Shel Dorff to go to a comic book convention, but Ray Bradbury would be there, and I wondered what Ray would be doing at a comic book convention, because I thought of him as a prose writer and a science fiction fan. But I immediately grabbed the opportunity, and I went to this Comic-Con. Well, my eyes were opened. Fans are a peculiar breed of people. They're historians. They're tremendous savers. They have their clutterbugs, every one of them. I saw this in this group that was together. I was looking at these people and I was thinking, these people have experienced what I've experienced through all these damn years of going to conventions, and most recently, almost every year, for an enormous number of years, I had been going to this comic book convention, and here I was with a bunch of people who had started the damn thing, and all of them are completely admiring of Shel Dorff, whom I had grown to be great friends with. I even went Steve Canyon's guy, what's his
Milton
name?
Kniff.
Yeah, Milton Kniff, to his house. Got a chance to meet his secretary, went there with Shel. And so now, here we are together, a group of us, and I'm reflecting upon the fact that we have known each other forever, and that a lot of the people I knew very, very little about, other than to greet them at conventions and party and that sort of thing. But you don't really get into a person's heart that way. You don't get a chance to find out what they like and what they don't like and what makes up their personality so different from others. But it was an astonishment to me that with all of the activity that Richard had put into conventions, he had financed a couple of them. I mean, he didn't want to be remembered as a guy who put up the money. But my God, somebody's got to put up the money. And if they don't, everybody looks at each other vacantly, wondering what's going to happen next. And so here was a guy who, I mean, when you're going to rent a hotel, you're going to get it, you're going to notify them 3-6 months in advance. They're going to screen you like nobody's business, and they want a lot of money. I heard it would cost, I wanted to put on a convention, I was told $30,000 just to option the thing. And if I didn't show up, I'd lose the money. And if my convention didn't materialize, well, I didn't do that convention, as you can very well imagine. The whole idea of putting out that much cash to, and yet here was a guy who had done it. And I knew about the comic kingdom, and I knew that comic books were the coming thing, and many of us had really prophesied that convention going was the coming thing. Like, if you know a little bit about conventions right now, in another 10, 15, 20 years, enormous numbers of people will come to these conventions. Take this one here, 125, 150,000, and another 50,000 who can't get tickets wandering the streets and clogging them up to honor what, in the, when I first started it, there was a stigma to reading a comic book. You hid it in another book if you rode on a bus and you wanted to read a comic, because this was for kids. This was hated by the school system. A man had written a book about the seduction of the innocent, in which he claimed that this was certainly corrupting everybody's world. And here was a guy who had put on a convention, Richard. Little did any of us realize that one of us would die when we went out to see Shell Dorff. I remember Shell. I could hardly recognize him. There was a look in his eye as though he really weren't quite there. And I wondered if he could even hear me. And I was with William Clausen. And I started in a very low voice talking to him. And I saw intelligence come back into his eyes. And the next thing you know, I could see that he was hearing what I was saying. So being a very verbal type, I spent 10 minutes, I guess, maybe less, but it seemed to me like a long time, reminding Shell of how important his inviting me to this convention was. My family, my wife and I, we would wait all year long, as many of you do, for this convention to come around. We were eager to come. We'd pile into my little Volkswagen, we'd come down here, we'd rent some obscure motel someplace, and then be an honored guest at the convention. So, anyway, here, the six of us looking at each other, we said, we got to do something about this, and we decided to form the Shell Dorff Fan Club. There was Mike Towery, and there was Craig, there was William, there was Clayton, and there was Richard, and there was me. And so we said, well, what will we call the club?
Cadillac. Greg.
Yeah.
And Greg Cadillac.
Right, yeah.
And Greg. what will we call this club? And I was thinking, well, comics are a very juvenile thing. So let's call it the Shell Dorff Fan Club. A fan club is just, my God, how sophisticated can you be? So, but it's got 200-300 members worldwide already. Greg is our president. We appointed him. We didn't elect him. We just said, you go do it, Greg.
And, okay,
and he's been doing it ever since. We've given away how many awards? Many, many, many of
probably
them.
Probably 50, 60 now.
Yeah, maybe 50, years. 60 commemorative paper honoring things for people who've made great contributions to fandom and to comics fandom. If now, I think on the gravestone, I would want to put a comic book fan.
Thanks, George. So we're kind of running short. Greg, you want to talk about...
Thanks. If you were lucky enough to have Richard as a close friend...
If you were lucky enough to have Richard as a close friend,
he would learn everything about you. And since he's gone, it's like a big part of my life has gone too, and I kind of feel selfish on that. But when we started the club, we went to the El Cortez, Nick the doorman from the 70s, he was a bartender, he remembered Richard and Shell. And I'm a very big believer in fate and destiny. To me, it's all science. But by Shell being sick and us having the club, we showed Richard the best time of his life for 3 years. We had events, a spaghetti factory, the awards banquet twice in 2 years. Bill Paul was there twice. Alan Scribner was there. Dave Davis came for the first time. Mike Rossi was there both times. And Richard, as you guys know, was the star of every party. He was the life of every party. In all these 3 years, doing our legacy, projects, the documentary, we knew better than anybody what would Richard want after he died. But we never thought about anybody dying. Me and Richard would have all these strategy meetings. How are we getting members? How are we going to get funds, raise money? We have a club where we're broke, virtually no dues. What do we do? And we kept coming up with stuff. And we'd talk about, hey, some people in the future might get married. They'll start businesses, network, right? But we never, ever talked about anybody dying. And by Shell being sick and us going there and being all unified and networking like that, I think those 3 years showed Richard, hopefully, the best time of his life. And what George said earlier, too, was that we did these awards and started signing them. The first one was the Sheldorf Best Friend of Fandom Award, and now it's the Planet El Cortez Donroom Award. And it's so much fun. We'd all get together and sign them, and people from their past, you know, would see an old name. And we gave one to Richard Lester at the Fandom Reunion Party, which the Comic-Con published it in the program book in the back. And I said, hey, Richard has to get the first one. But a few months later, he's gone. And the love out there, there are still get-togethers now in honor of Richard out since January. And things are still going. The Comics Fest will be something. The archives in a year will have a reception at State once his archives is all, you know, well documented. And the main thing about Richard is a good friend. A lot of people don't know. I have a really good memory of the 70s and 80s. In the late 70s, early 80s, me and Richard would visit Bill Paul a few times in his home. His three main girlfriends that I can remember are Katie, Rosie, and the last one, I won't give the last name, Kathy, was a San Diego County Sheriff Deputy. That's a whole other story I'll tell you in private.
And don't forget his cat. Don't forget his cat.
And Clayton Moore was also a committee member of the convention at one time, a good friend of Richard's.
Yeah, I was on the Comic-Con committee from 1972 through about 1986. And during that time, I had no contact with Richard Alf at all. So he was... I got on the committee probably in 75, 74, 75. I was in high school. And one of the things about Sheldorf, we were reminiscing last night at our little meet and greet event in room 28. Shell was big on giving opportunities to young people. And, you know, you look at the group that he assembled there, and that's who came out, young people, to work with Shell. That was trust on both sides of them. And I was a friend of Shell's because I was on the committee during a lot of his tenure. And as I got into the finished college and moved to Los Angeles, I worked for Ken Kruger at Bud Plant Distribution. Sheldorf recommended me for that job. So I was a good friend of Shell's, and Shell was a good friend of Richard's. And over the years, I'd come back and visit Shell when I came through San Diego, and occasionally I'd meet Richard. And I saw Richard kind of after all this period. Richard was an entrepreneur. The business he started, Comic Kingdom, there's still a comic book store on Comic Ground in that same location. And Richard told me that that location is now famous as a comic book destination for visitors to San Diego, which goes back to when he established it. And Richard was a cool guy to hang around with. He had many, many diverse interests, and lots of different people knew him, and not all the people who knew him knew each other, as we found out when we went to his memorial. You know, so I crossed Richard's path later on. I played disc golf, I'd do some other outside activities, and we had some of those in common. So I'd see Richard when I came back to town on occasion. He liked to eat. We'd go out to eat. There's places all around town where we ate and made plans and talked about stuff. And when Shell fell ill, I came to town a few times. Richard and I would go out to see him and network to go see him brew. And of course, the irony is nobody suspected that Richard was harboring a disease. So everybody would see the doctor. Okay? You never know what you got going on in there until they take a look for you. And I've had another friend who was an older guy in his early 60s, a very healthy guy, run around and all of a sudden had a heart attack. So, you know, the hidden message here is take care of ourselves for each other. And Richard was certainly good at doing that. As people have commented here, he looked out for other people. He was a bachelor, he was a busy guy. So, you know, we're all thinking very fondly about Richard and all the things that he did, and the ripple effect of what he did continues to expand. There's a program at San Diego State that's going to be an archive that began with Richard's papers and is going to expand, I understand, to cover the early days of the convention and how it organically formed. The key thing for me about this convention, and I got involved in it early on and stay involved with it, it's a non-profit corporation. It's not about the money that people come here, or none of you all here. It's because of the thing that we do, and the things that we enjoy and we celebrate and we perpetuate by celebrating. And he was all about that. All about that. The things Richard liked were, I don't know what it's called. Will you remember what that's called? That Mexican jazz-oriented cinema that
you like to
watch? Rumbera. See, I learned so many things hanging around with Richard, things I never knew existed. And, you know, we all turn each other on to other stuff.
William Foster.
Oh yeah, I'll make it real brief because we're running out of time here. Basically what brought me and Richard together was that little ad in Marvel Comics that said, order from the Comic Kingdom, we'll send you a free comic with your order. And the comic that came was about yay size. It was ALF number 1. And I ordered Iron Man 55 by Jim Starlin for my Thanos collection. And it came with a page missing. So, at the first convention I went to in 1975, I ran into Steve Garris, who had done the ALF comic. And he's going, hey, I did this comic. I go, well, that's not exactly the kind of free comic I was expecting, but... And then I started complaining that Iron Man 55 came with a page missing. And he goes, well, I'll take you to the guy that sold you the comic. So he takes me to Richard ALF in the dealer's room, and Richard goes, hey, how's it going? Yeah, I got another Iron Man 55 right here. He gives it to me. And, So, and we hit it off ever since. Every time I come to San Diego, I get together with them, you know, up until the end. And I was slated to do ALF number 3 in 1977, which featured the Death of Cthulhu, but Steve Garris, the creator, told me it looked like the Death of Casper. So he gave it the axe. So I put it aside, and then a couple of years ago, Richard convinced me to finish the book. So here it is, and there's free copies for everyone after the panel.
Yay.
And ALF number 3, I finished the story, and it's dedicated to Richard ALF and Shel Dorf.
And
his origin. I thought about that one.
His origin. One of the other things that Richard was interested in, got involved in, was a group of people that had a thing called the Leo Party. And Earl Bookhammer is one of them, and with Richard was in his final stages, and we knew he wasn't going to recover. Just he didn't want to pass away in an institution or a hospital. So Earl took him into his home, and that's where Richard passed away. And would you like to say something, Earl?
Well, my wife Vicki and I took Richard in. January 4th, I think it was the 3rd. Well, Richard said he didn't want to go in the hospital. He couldn't go home because, well, his house was full of Comic-Con archives from the floor to the ceiling, every room. I think some of y'all know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, a little bit.
There was other stuff, too.
There was other stuff, but 1970 on, his original archive stuff was in his room. Wasn't doing well at the hospital. He looked at me one day and says, Earl, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I'm trying to help take care of you, Richard. You know, Mr. Nurse for 30 years. He says, you know, I got nurses that look a whole lot better than you. Take care of me. He says, why don't you go take care of my stuff? I said, what stuff? He says, all my archives and stuff, all my collections. And I said, with an old man like me, it'll be 2:30 in the morning. I called Ed. I said, Ed, I need some help. I need to get all this stuff out of Richard's house. So I did it that night. Got all Richard's stuff safely into a safe place. All his stuff's going to go to SDSU, most of it, to Mr. Lincoln's Michael.
Yes,
I'm there somewhere over yeah. there.
Mike, yeah.
Mike helped get all Richard's stuff together. I can't tell you how many other people that were involved in helping getting all of Richard's stuff together and making sure it goes where it's supposed to belong. I'm talking everything. So it's the original programs, the original signed things from Shell Dorf and these, all these comic people and Mr. William and Clayton and all these folks.
And Rusty and Betty.
Rusty. So I can't even tell you how many people
Fred
were in
that. Kathy, Jim Kennington, all the people that helped out when Richard fell ill. I mean, I can't remember everybody, but I just want to make sure you guys know that you're not forgotten. My name's Ed Cormier, and I was helping out Richard. I was helping Richard the last 2 years archive his documents. He thought that was going to be the future because he saw that people would be able to view a lot of this stuff on disk. In a digital format, or through the internet. He knew that they only existed in the two-dimensional world, and they wanted it to be something that people could share through the internet and all that. So,
thanks. So we just have a few minutes left here, and if Richard was proud of what happened with Comic-Con and his involvement in it. In 2009, Comic-Con had the 40th anniversary and brought a lot of us back together and renewed our interest in Comic-Con, and Richard was really proud of that and happy, and David Lanzer here is representing Comic-Con, and would like to say a few words.
Yeah, one of the things that you and Richard and really made my job much easier was when you would... We always get people who say, you know, I've been going to Comic-Con for a long time. This is going to be my 10th year. And we really don't like the fact that, you know, it started as just comics, and now it's got movies and all this stuff up as well. And Richard would always say, you know, no, it started out as being comics and movies and fantasy literature. And it's great to have this kind of a panel with you people here talking about that because history gets revised. And if we don't keep going back and reminding people, they'll create their own history.
Yeah.
So one of the great things also with Shell was, you know, he would call me up every once in a while, and I didn't know Shell very well.
Say,
whenever he called, you know.
Can I say one thing there?
Sure.
I mean, you got to remember Shell Dorf coming from Detroit. It was called the Detroit Triple Fan.
Well, exactly. And that's like, one of the things we would...
I've been to every one of these summers and stuff like that. It's never just been about comics.
Right, right. Yeah. And Shell would always say, you know, you guys are doing a good job. It seems to be growing. You know, there was always this apprehension, I think. But you guys really, honestly, Richard and everybody here deserves a hand because I don't know that anybody thought that Comic-Con would become what it is today. And while it's different today than it was in 1970, even the 1980 show was different from the 1970 show. But you know what? There's a whole new group of people here. For them, hopefully, you know, right. God willing, in 40 years, they'll look back on what they had, and hopefully it'll be as special to them as it is to all of us.
It was really important for Richard that he had done and what he accomplished and his legacy would be preserved and made available to people. And Mr. Rob Ray from San Diego State, can you just talk, just mention what it is that you're going to be doing to accomplish that?
Well, I'm head of Special Collections and University Archives at the library, and Richard's material will be coming there. I had the pleasure of meeting Richard only once, but he came and looked at our comics collection, his movies collection, and we talked to him, and he was confident that we cared about preserving the material and making it available, making it safe and secure, and that's what we do. We're the preservation agent for the university. We serve our students, but we also serve the San Diego community as it struggles to understand and explain itself. We're kind of superheroes ourselves fighting this never-ending battle against mold and rusted paper clips to document truth and get to the bottom of who we are. Just a moment, Richard Alf at the age of 17, thinking of this, the legacy of this person, co-chair for the first Comic-Con and chair for the second and again co-chair for the third. He provided business sense, funds, transportation, energy, hard work, enthusiasm, good cheer, and social vision that proved essential to establishing Comic-Con as a viable institution. So while we say this and pay tribute to Richard now, how soon will this pass? and be forgotten. And the answer, unfortunately, is relatively soon without any documentation of this preserved for future recollection. Richard's collection is roughly 20 linear feet. It's Comic-Con related, including Detroit stuff. Material related to his comic book business and the Comic Kingdom store. Some original art by Jack Kirby and Scott Shaw, and material on the Empire Sign Company he was involved with. We already have documented very briefly Richard's early career. There's an October 18, 1974 Daily Aztec article where there's a wonderful picture of Richard in his 25,000 comic books. And in that article he says he plans to sell the comics business and move on to something else soon. So from what I've heard today...
They're holding up the stop sign for us, so if you get...
Well,
make the final word for Richard.
What I've heard today is that Richard isn't that much about comics as he is a generous, unassuming, gentle person providing business sense and so forth, and this social vision. He was one of the founders, these teenagers in the late 60s, who, teenagers, yet they were highly literate, voracious readers, thinking for themselves, part of a youth revolution, turning the culture upside down. The archives should help us understand this change over time, which is what history is about. If we look around at this astonishing Comic-Con phenomenon, we are compelled to ask, what was it that was unleashed in 1970 that has led to this marvel, this spectacle that has changed the world? And the archive should help us understand and explain.
Thanks.